Well, I'm glad you came again. Glad you came for the third lesson. Just a couple of comments on what we're doing for those of you that have missed the first or whatever, don't understand what we're doing here. We're going to finish up the neo-evangelical study in the session. I don't know how long it'll take, but what I did or what I am doing is, since it's a current issue, I took what happens after 70 years of neo-evangelicalism and looked at it today and its product. Then we'll go back and look what happened that brought us to this point. Part of it is that it'll help you understand how important it was that certain things along the way were compromised, and we end up where we are. So we end up at a place where we're really kind of surprised that we would end up, and that's a place called Christian Marxism. And for of some of us that are older, we did a lesson last week to understand how much of an oxymoron that is. We just, the last thing I could have ever thought would be that there would be talking about Christian Marxism when everybody knows Marxism is an atheistic, anti-God system that was defeated, again, comes to life. But then we find that it's in the evangelical left wing of the church. All right, what else I'm going to tell you before we go? Well, I gambled last week that I had 80 slides and I finished. I have just about that many this week too, so that means I cannot ad lib a lot, and I can't stand here and talk much either, so let's get going on it. Remember last week, we ended on the personage of Tim Keller, a Christian Marxist. We wondered at the oxymoron, a God-claiming person linked to a God-forsaking atheistic system. What could ever be mutually appealing to both of these opposing ideologies? And the answer was social justice, which brings us to the ultimate goal of utopia. Now, it's not hard to understand why atheist Karl Marx, 1850-ish, 1840s, meant to establish utopia on earth without acknowledging the creator God. He got the idea from the Bible, though, by supposing to solve the age-old problem of evil. He thought that inequities found in humanity was brought about by the ruling class who exploited the poor. When exploitation would stop, utopia would naturally follow. But Marx started from zero knowledge, only assumed knowledge that he came up with. But what about Keller? What was his starting point? Being a Christian, he did not need to start from zero as Marx did. Keller had a library of information, we call the Bible, available to consult about how God ordered the economic, social, culture. This we call the software. Well, there he could have learned that misery does not come from inequities, wants, or needs, but from a God-authored judgment on the world due to sin, which was levied at the fall and again another layer of it at the flood judgment, the results of which continue into our time as suffering, want, inequities, pain, wars, and death, and I could go on, and I could go on, and I could go on. So what makes a Christian commit such a fundamental error? Well, we need to look closely at the man Tim Keller. What makes him turn sharply to the left and join the ideas of atheistic Marxism? We all want to know. So it's in his own words. I was raised in a mainline Lutheran church in eastern Pennsylvania when I reached my teens in the early 1960s. The time came for me to attend confirmation class, a two-year course that covered Christian beliefs, practices, and history. And I'm going to say it's interesting the way he explains what went on in those classes. Its aim was to bring young people into a fuller understanding of the faith so they could publicly commit to it. Is that not an interesting choice of words? Publicly commit to it. My teacher for the first year was a retired minister. He was quite traditional and conservative, speaking often of the danger of hell and the need for great faith, another interesting choice of words. In the second year of the course, however, the instructor was a new young cleric who was just out of seminary. He was a social activist and was filled with deep doubts about traditional Christian doctrine, and he's teaching these kids. It was almost like being instructed in two different religions. In the first year, we stood before a holy, just God whose wrath could only be turned aside, again, interesting choice of words, at great effort and cost. And I say oops here a little bit, because I think of mainlined moralism. In the second year, we heard of the spirit of love in the universe, ooh, sounds like Gaia to me, who mainly required that we work for human rights and the liberation of the oppressed. My family later found its way to a more conservative church in a small Methodist denomination. And I do not know what that would have been. Usually the smaller Methodist denominations tend to be more conservative, like the Holiness Methodist or the Wesleyan Methodist. Or the smaller, they tend to be more evangelical, although a little charismatic. For years, this strengthened what could be called the hellfire layer. And my religious formation, again, interesting choice of words, religious formation. Although the pastor and people were personally very gentle, as could be, I guess, in spite of preaching about hell. Then I went off to one of those fine, liberal, smaller universities in the Northeast, which quickly began to throw water on the hellfire in my imagination. The history and philosophy departments were socially radicalized and heavily influenced by the neo-Marxist critical theory of the Marxist school, and hold those thoughts, we'll explain both of those in a bit. The neo-Marxist critical theory of the Frankfurt School. The social activism was particularly attractive, and the critique of the American bourgeois, which means the materialistic middle class, which Marx felt disdain for, because they were kind of the ruling class. Okay, the social activism was particularly attractive, and the critique of the American bourgeois society was compelling, but its philosophical underpinnings were confusing to me, and I don't know why he would say that. I don't know why that confused him. He just said that. So he's posed here with this choice. His choice, the old Lutheran or the new Marxist idea on social activism. Well, he admits that he's emotionally drawn to the social activism of the neo-Marxist. He said, how could I turn back to a kind of Orthodox Christianity, notice Orthodox Christianity, that supported segregation in the South and apartheid in South America? And interesting, again, with this idea of kind of Christianity. And I likely would say at this point, I'm not sure he understands saving faith. It doesn't come up in the discussion. Or anything about his personal sin or the righteousness of God and how that's expiated by his death. Nothing of that is said. This is in his words. Tim Keller explains that when he found a band of brothers, a group of Christians who had concern for justice in the world, and again, grounded in the nature of God, things began to change for him. Nature of God. And just what does that mean? Now, if you go into the Bible, you might be able to discover that. But he just says the nature of God. So the choices really are for him to go back to Lutheran liberalism and do a personal moral good to work to save yourself from hell. And I suggest to you that this is the old liberal views that would see Habitat for Humanity. You see the Lutheran churches build a house on their parking lot every, 2 years, 3 years? You know, a token effort to do something. That's kind of the liberalism of the old days. And the social activists, in the spirit of love, do good for others, work to save others from oppression, by the way, which God approves, and woke to the oppression of capitalism and fundamentalism. That's what he chooses. He doesn't mention anything about saving souls by proclaiming the gospel, to work to save others from hell. By the way, God saves sinners by the death, burial, resurrection of Christ. We know that. So do we have any evidence that he understood personal salvation? I would say, so far as I can tell, no. one of the things I brought up, critical theory. This is probably very interesting. And it's not what it looks like. It's a kind of a play on words. We mentioned last week that Marx Bernstein, I have his date somewhere, 1850 to 1932. And by the way, I'm going to say this here before I forget, and I'm not anti-Semitic when I say this, but on these thinkers that shaped culture, the Marxist culture, I'm going to say 9 out of 10 or 9 and a half out of them were Jewish people. And part of it's they're brilliant. And my commentary on that is, when God blinds somebody, they are blinded, right? Yeah, but they have the ability to sort of noodle out a system, right, that somebody else can't figure out. Now, it's not right, but I'm just impressed. And some of them, these websites, I looked at pictures, and I think they're almost anti-Jewish because they say, he's a Jew, he's a Jew, he's a Jew, he's a Jew, you know, like it's almost. I'm not saying that when I'm saying this. I'm just saying they were Jewish. And I say it's not surprising because they are blinded and they still have their intellect and their ability. All right? And Bernstein was Jewish, by the way, just by the name. So we mentioned last week that Marx Bernstein, after Marx, and then Leonard after Bernstein, only they lived at the same time. Leonard actually died before Bernstein did. Were all Marxist communitarians. We call them communists. And they did not agree on how to implement the drastic change in a nation, that is from capitalism to Marxism. Was it by peace or by violence? Marx would have probably said by peace. Bernstein said by peace. Lenin said by violence and tried it by violence. So the debate from Bernstein lasted for decades into the 20th century. The only real effort to establish Marxism was Lenin in Russia. I had that last week. He chose to do it by force, skipping the peaceful step, which Marx expected, and restored to violence. And I don't know what the right number here is. Maybe you remember what I put in. Is there 10,000 to 20,000, 100 to 200,000? I think it's 10 to 20,000. I think it's the right number here. And I got a little confused as to how many died under communism, and that's a bigger number. But those that died under Lenin, I think it's between 10 and 20,000. He executed in a very short time, a couple of years. So that number should be corrected. Okay, 1923, this is before Lenin dies, but he has had strokes, but the disaster in Russia is well known, at least for people that are informed. By 1923, the failure of that approach was evident. I want to say this about the French Revolution. This is something I don't know that you think about. But in the French Revolution, it was pointed out that it changed the world because it was now going to consider the possibility of living without the idea of God in culture, that they could escape God and live with humanity, and that all the problems that we had with God would go away and man would function successfully on his own, and there would be peace and prosperity and help and health and the joy on earth. So the French Revolution was the first opportunity for man to do that. If you think back over the history, when would it have done it? Couldn't have done it during the time when the Catholic Church was in charge. You go clear back to when the Romans were in charge. So the French Revolution was really remarkable in that it was the first opportunity to try something else on for size, and when they could actually do it. And there was nothing to run, no rails to run on. So they came with ideas of the brilliant people. Again, here we have Jewish people get involved and they come with ideas because we sort of got cut off from the past. And it's sort of like now you got to start over and build something fresh that we've never had before. And you really didn't have two choices. You either have capitalism or individualism, or you've got communitarianism where you do things as a group. So those are the two choices. And of course, during the French Revolution, some of those got very intoxicated with the idea of socialism, but there was not much freedom in the French Revolution, and they were executed. Remember Babeuf? But we had others that picked up, like Robert Owen. Somehow, the people in the French Revolution, the thinkers, you think of Voltaire and these guys, they were always talking against God and against the church, although Voltaire was still buried in the Catholic Church, after all. Because some on their mind, they thought God and capitalism somehow are connected, and they probably are. And that system had always ruled the world, and you had nothing but trouble. Remember, they don't go back to the source of the trouble. They just look at, you know, the newspaper headlines and say, there's trouble in the world, it's got to be us. It's got to be the system. And since God's part of the system, we've got to get rid of God, and part of the system is capitalism, we've got to get rid of capitalism, we've got to come up with something else. So the French Revolution was an opportunity for man to, for the first time, actually flex his wings. So the revolution challenged the religion so well, entrenched, but the revolution in France allowed limited freedom. As I said, communitarian philosophers were executed. The theories of the source of evil is the bottom of this question. I'll again go back to Voltaire and these guys that were meeting in these lounges and salons, and, you know, had nothing to do but discuss things. They would talk about this, and here's a solution that Marx comes up with, that here's the cause of evil, and it's the inequities in the culture. So last week we had this line of communitarianists. First one, we had start Robert Owen, the industrialist, that start tried it in Indiana, Friedrich Engels, and Germany and England, Karl Marx, Bernstein, Lenin, and Stalin. Then we have Lenin in Russia under the experiment, and which was a failure. And we asked the question, where's the peace? You know, somebody said, where's the meat? I said, well, where's the peace? Well, it didn't come forth from Russia, nor did it until 1953 and after, because under Stalin it was even worse. So the Frankfurt, Germany school. I'm not told everything about the critical theory, I will yet. The early beginnings of the Frankfurt school emphasized the reformulation of Marxism. Remember, Marx is now 75 years old, and system, we've had a real disaster in Russia, with hundreds of thousands, tens of thousands at least, being killed, not the way it's supposed to be. So the Marxist proletariat revolution was not going well according to plan. As signified by World War I, the people came out of World War I were the working class. They rather aligned with their classes and with the nations, and then they fought each other rather than joining up to fight capitalism. So that didn't work out. World War I was supposed to be the promise of this big revolution. Of course, Lenin takes over after that because it didn't happen in World War, and he did it on his own. So these socialist regimes under Lenin, Trotsky, and Stalin in Russia then spawned in 1917 the Bolshevik Revolution in Russia. Marxist intellectuals gathered in the Weimar Republic, that's the German Berlin's headquarters, to discuss why the revolution had not taken place in Europe. Remember, they thought it would go on in England because all the industrialists were there. It couldn't go on in Germany because there were so many laws against socialism. So we saw that in Russia, but it was forced, so there, you know, something's not happening that should go on. So they returned to the drawing board to perform a searching re-examination of the very foundation of Marxist theory, and they should have picked it up and thrown it out the window. No. But with the dual hope of explaining past errors and preparing for the future action. Remember, there aren't other choices. Either you have individuals or you have groups. So the Frankfurt School was explicitly created to this research and planning, and we can do who funded it and all that kind of stuff, to become a major force in the revitalization of Western European Marxism in the post-war years. It started out in Europe and then it came to the United States, as I'll say in a minute. So initially established in 1923 by Felix Weil, a young Marxist thinker. The aim of this institute was to bring together different strands of Marxist thinking into an interdisciplinary research center and moved to New York in 1933. Remember, these guys were Jewish, and what happens in Germany in the 30s? The heat got turned on the Jews, so they left. Some of them were smart enough to see it coming. So many of these are Jewish thinkers. Their move to New York changed their focus from Germany to the United States. Now, this guy put the Jewish thing on the head. That's why I think these probably little anti-Semitic sites that I wouldn't have done that, so excuse that. So Marx Horkheimer is one of the two early members here. The other one's Marcuse. The revolution won't happen with guns. Rather, it will happen incrementally, year by year, generation by generation. We will gradually infiltrate the educational institutions and the political office, transforming them slowly into Marxist entities as we move toward universal egalitarianism, where everything is the same. So the Frankfurt School employed a technique invented by Horkheimer, which you saw, called a critical theory, the play on words here. A social theory oriented towards critiquing and changing society as a whole. Now, I'm going to say this, I didn't put this in my notes, but when we start talking about this stuff, the religion and politics actually meld together. Because what you can say about the politics, you can say about the religion. And what you say about the religion, you can say about the politics. So when you go through this, you'll think political. You don't need to. You'd also think about Christianity, okay? So the Frankfurt School employed a technique invented by Horkheimer called critical theory, a social theory oriented towards critiquing and change society as a whole. Now, what was the device? The point of the theory is to criticize critical theory, to criticize, a play on words, to criticize every traditional social institution. Okay, now what are these social institutions? We have marriage, we've got government, we've got responsibility, you know, things that we usually function with. And you think about that, those all really are Christian principles that we live in the West. You can go to the Bible and see this is how it was put together. So in a sense, it's criticized every Christian social institution because that's all we had. That's the one they attacked. And another interesting thing, to specifically avoid offering any alternatives, just attack, don't say, well, this would be better. Now, you might notice this on a political team. That is always what is happening. Never is there an alternative suggestion. It's just, that's wrong. What's better? Well, that's wrong. Nothing. Okay, got it? So they attack, but don't offer any alternatives. And this is a means to break down Western culture. Again, I'm saying Christian culture. So a better alternative way is never to be offered, only criticism. Well, at Columbia, this university in New York, I think it is, the Frankfurt School shifted their focus from critical theory directed at German society to critical theory directed at American society. Although they did not coin the term, critical theory provided the origin of political correctness. Critical theory is a play on words, a play on semantics. The theory was simple. Criticize every pillar of Western culture, family, democracy, common law, freedom of speech, and others. The hope was these attacks will finally crumble the pillars and that would crumble Christianity under the pressure. And I say, you probably don't see this in our church. We're a dispensational church. We don't have any of that going on, but we do see it in the culture. Remember, there's not really any difference where it's applied. It's applied wherever it can. Okay, we've not finished with Tim Keller yet. So interestingly, he became interested in shaping and initiating new Christian communities. We call them churches. And thus he entered the ministry just a few years after college, living out the neo-Marxist ideology of the Frankfurt School within the church, which became the goal of his life. This is his words. Well, I'm sorry, these are words by E.S. Williams, who's an associate in London where Spurgeon was. He had a book on this, The New Calvinist. Well, he claims the purpose of Jesus, this is Keller now, the purpose of Jesus coming is to put the whole world aright, to renew and restore the creation. Is that kind of biblical? Well, is it? Yes, it is. But just get the timing right now. The purpose of Jesus coming is to put the whole world right. I mean, we know he died on the cross, but he came to fix the curse. He's going to undo the curse, all right? To renew and restore creation, that's right. Not just to bring personal forgiveness and peace, but also justice and shalom. So he takes these things that are true, mix them in the wrong time, and it seems biblical. And I say this, Ed, that's me. This certainly is the promise in the kingdom of the Messiah. Notice how the kingdom now is a red herring for the covenantalists who think the kingdom is here already, and they chase it. So the statement has a certain amount of in common with the thinking of liberation theology. Some of you remember this from Latin America. For in liberation theology, the gospel is not a message about saving individuals out of the world, but rather a message of saving the world. little more comment here. The Sandinistas were communists attempting to overthrow the dictatorship to liberate Nicaragua in 1978 during Reagan's days. Their message was liberation and equality for all, a ploy during the Cold War to gain foothold in the Western Hemisphere by the Russians. Kellerstadt says that the world and our hearts are broken. Jesus' life and death and resurrection was an infinitely costly rescue operation to restore justice to the oppressed and the marginalized, physical wholeness to the diseased and dying, community to the isolated and lonely, and spiritual joy and connection to those alienated from God. Well, he should have got it from the Bible, but he didn't. So he explains that Jesus offers his lifeblood in order to honor moral justice and merciful love so that someday he can destroy all evil without destroying us. Also, he claimed that when Jesus suffered with us, he was identifying with the oppressed of the world, not with their oppressors. And I don't quite understand that statement. Williams, our author of the book, New Calvinists. Some Bible-believing Christians may overgenerously read into these sentiments an evangelical message. But Tim Keller's goal is to a great extent incongruous with, even antagonistic to, the purposes of the gospel revealed in God's word. He holds, William boldly declares, Jesus identified with the oppressed in like manner. Liberation theology claims that the God revealed in the Bible, biblical tradition in general, and in Jesus Christ in particular, wills the liberation of the oppressed and is active in the world towards that end. Tim Keller claims that his new way of thinking about the Bible, he always liked the new way of thinking about the Bible, is essentially the old liberation theology of the Latin American Roman Catholics, which he does not give credit for. The Jesuit priest Juan Luis Sergego, or however you say it in Spanish, one of the most important figures in liberation theology movement, explains, he says, God himself or herself, through Christ, assumes and participates with us in the historical process of humanization and liberation, for this is the plan of God for humankind. Like them, of liberation theology of the social issue, Tim Keller swerves or departs from the central message of Scripture, that is, a doomed world that cannot be restored except by the coming of Christ and end-time events. So this is an invention by deviant thinkers adopted by Tim Keller to provide his new way of thinking about the Bible. This heterodox interpretations are used by Keller to support his insistence that the church is called to bring about societal justice. It is a thesis that fits with the spirit of the age rather than the work of the Spirit of God. So we have in our lesson planned two flags for you to follow. One flag represented by the gospel based on the vicarious death on behalf of sinners who by faith can be justified. The alternative flag represents a gospel for the community that views the death of Christ as an example to release our energies for the oppressed and save the world. The flag to save the classes in the community will be highly attractive to the personally unredeemed. Many of these are at home in our traditional gospel-believing, if not gospel-preaching churches, but not saved. They find in themselves an emptiness, a restlessness, a yearning for something more, seeking a purpose that has not been satisfied. They have not found it in traditional Christianity because they have not tasted of it, but they think they have. In the picture Tim Keller and others paint, he points to, while avoiding evangelical fundamentalist language, the heroic figure seen in a divine Christ, a heroic figure in the divine Christ. What an example. Who champions the cause of the oppressed. He offers a life filled with meaning and purpose by helping the oppressed. So the most susceptible are the young of the Reformed churches. They have always seen the church as a change agent for society. And again, this is coming out of the Reformed churches. Remember the purpose statements of the Gospel Coalition, which, by the way, Tim Keller was the signer of them. One of those guys was in the Gospel Coalition. He was a head guy with D.A. Carson. They've always seen the church as a change agent for society. Remember the purpose statements of the Gospel Coalition. The mission of the Gospel Coalition is to encourage and educate current and next generation Christian leaders by advocating gospel-centered principles and practices. Already off the rails. It has a very strong Calvinistic bent, which seems to make them safe, with an emphasis on cultural transformation. These guys are susceptible to changing the world because it's in their constitution, so to speak. What is the gospel? The question is, how does one hold his place in the meaning of the gospel if the meaning of it can be changed to a cultural matter? The second, even more dangerous, is that the language or the vocabulary or the meaning of the term gospel can be easily loaded with a foreign meaning and then used for other purposes. And that's, the gospel is the most flexible word, I think, in the Bible. Thirdly, it is one thing for the young people of the Reformed churches to be led astray to social causes, but it hits close to home when some of our own begin to be influenced by this kind of gospel think. Our young are exposed to this in the schools and so forth. I don't think they can be sheltered from it. Some of the Reformer leaders are born again, I'm sure, believers, and they are seen as trustworthy because they are believers, and they become models, like John Piper is one such. Now here's Piper. We're going to get to Fuller Seminary eventually. Piper attended Wheaton College, majored in literature and minoring in philosophy, studied romantic literature with Clyde Kilby, studying him. Stimulated his poetic side, and today he regularly composes poetry to celebrate special family occasions as well as annually composing story poems. Isn't that nice? For his congregation during the 4 weeks of Advent. In college, he was originally on the pre-medicine track, only to decide to go into ministry during a bout of sickness while listening to the sermons of Harold Ockengay. We'll see him next week over the radio from his hospital bed. He then completed a Bachelor of Divinity degree at Fuller Theological Seminary in Pasadena, California. While Fuller, he took several courses from Daniel Fuller, who was influenced greatly by Karl Barth. Comes back and changes Fuller's school from dispensationalism to covenant. And through him, he discovered the writings of Jonathan Edwards, along with C.S. Lewis. Questionable. He's good in some ways. Edwards, New England, Fuller are noted influences. Daniel Fuller, not Charles. Daniel Fuller are noted influences of Piper's life ministry, and it still shows. Now, he's hard to read. Piper advocates, that's hard to attack guys, it's hard to read because you probably misunderstand him. I said, well, if he can't be clear, then I can misunderstand, right? So I look at it. Piper advanced Christian hedonism. Hedonism was that sort of idea, it's a selfish thing, you know. Usually it's not associated with Christian living, you know. It's not the excesses of life that you enjoy. But he plays on the word a little bit. Piper advocates Christian hedonism and teaches that God is most glorified in us when we are most satisfied with him, and that God's highest pursuit, his glory, and man's deepest and most durable happiness comes together in one pursuit, namely, in the pursuit of joy in God. Well, I have to say, I'm hard to disagree with the sounds of that statement, although I'm not sure exactly what he means by it. It seems nebulous to me. So we must guess at the roots of this desire for God. We know, beyond the normal Christian recognition and appreciation for his grace, for our salvation and our adoption, but joy in God must have some expression. I suppose, then, it is in the worship. And I think he says this is the highest act of a Christian. Again, a bit nebulous, because I asked you somewhere recently, somebody, when do we worship? So to put tangible sense to this worship experience, we understand it as somewhat borrowed from the worship of the life of Israel. You know, there's no distinction with Israel and the church. That's somewhat blended together. That form, a form that includes some kind of sacrificing. That's kind of part of this whole system. You give up of yourself somehow. Not that God gave up for us. We have to give up for him. Half-truth. The worship borrows from the high church that associates worship with a place and activity. And in the Protestant churches that focus less on liturgy. So what's left? Well, we have worship leaders, and they are the musicians. We even call our guy that leads our music. Is it any wonder that the musical sources used in our churches come from these Reformed musical groups, Hillsong and Getty? And there's others, I'm sure, but pick on these. These songs are categorized as praise and worship songs. They have generally one theme that is an expression of praise to the God who is being praised. Our church filters carefully the music that is used, but it's hard to know the premise of the songs that imply that worship is only in praise. And I always have this caveat. I think whatever music we do in our church primarily is interpreted by the church, not by the author. Okay, but that doesn't always work. That doesn't always work, but I've always said that. So if something is, you wonder what that song really meant, well, look at the theology of the church. That's what it means, if there's any question. Because we're not going to change theology because the song said something not quite as clear as you'd like it to be. So the local place defines the music, but still. So out of the music culture, this summer, two of the worship leaders of Hillsong, Pastor Joshua Harris, pastor of a large church, filled the pulpit of this C.J. Mahoney, which was a founding pastor of the Gospel Together, the other group of the Gospel Coalitions, the Gospel Together, Together for the Gospel. Mahoney founded that, or was part of it. So when he left that church, Joshua Harris filled it for 11 years. Recently denied the Christian faith, this last year, in the summer. Another, Marty Sampson, worship leader for Hillsong, August 19, 2019, writer of more than 300 songs, also has denied the faith. So good lyrics may not always be what they appear to be. There's a small margin between God as our Savior and God as our hero. These themes can be so monolithic to make a singer lose touch and sing for music's sake. And I remind myself, I had such people in the choir when we sang the old stuff. People came to sing just because they wanted to sing, not necessarily believers. I try to sort them out, but, you know, can't always do it. So we live in a culture of Christianity. Our churches, family, and personally, we are influenced by error. While we may not be personally ascribed to a God who is our hero, we are influenced by the culture who sees him that way. So worship, I think, is attributing to God that which is due him. We call it obedience. We would say obedience is the first order of worship. Listening submissively to the word is the highest form of our corporate worship service that we do together, and there are others that we could say. So we get the social justice. What is it? Is there a biblical answer? Now, we have said that a flawed view of the kingdom leads to a scandalized view of the gospel. George Ladd has made the gospel of the kingdom, good news about the kingdom, to mean the good news of salvation that comes to us by the kingdom. So the kingdom becomes the operative force in our life. So if the kingdom brings us the gospel, then we must be about building the kingdom because our collective salvation depends on it. So if the kingdom is God's work on earth, then we must do what is necessary. No sacrifice, too great. Pick the hardest thing and do the righteous deeds. Nothing but the best. It will inspire others to do the same if I do it. It is through our example, seeing Jesus suffer in obedience, even to the cross, that we work to create heaven on earth just as Jesus prayed. Misunderstood. When this is the commitment of your life, you have been woke. Woke means being conscious of racial discrimination in society and other forms of oppression and injustice. Before woke, bad grammar, but before woke, Christians were concerned for the salvation of the soul. A woke Christian has moved on, working to eliminate discrimination rather than saving the souls, which people do not like to do anyway. Or it'll happen anyway, however they say it, I don't know. So we have the critical assumption of Reformed theology, which I've heard me do this before, do it a little different for you every time. The right system is the Old Testament comes, the church comes, the Lord will come back, and then the kingdom is established. Now the kingdom starts to migrate. It's on wheels. So the kingdom now comes into the church age. Now the kingdom is here. And if you're a millennial, sort of saying, well, yeah, there's a kingdom here. Someday the Lord will come back. I'm not sure what that means. But then we'll go to heaven, wherever that is, usually in some other place in another dimension. So that's usually the amillennial reading. And then there's the covenant reform reading. See, it migrates even differently. The kingdom and heaven now blend. So the kingdom on earth is everything there is. And some say, you know, you kind of mix between amillennialism and postmillennialism. You know, amillennialism is the middle bar. The postmillennialism is the bottom bar. And it doesn't change much. It doesn't take much to change which one it is. So Christ's coming to bring the kingdom came at his first coming, not at his second coming. And since they're not really into eschatology, I don't know if they ever mentioned that he's coming back or not. If he does, it probably doesn't matter in their system. So we have this bottom one, the kingdom and the social concern, just like quicksand. So Christian Marxist reform, Christ died for the oppressed. Now that strikes me very, very unbiblical. And what really strikes me that these people are still considered in the evangelical camp. By who? I don't know. Well, I do know. So social justice and the kingdom. There's much confusion about this dilemma, this social justice stuff. And remember, we don't have this word in the Bible. What are social justice causes? Well, according to woke theology, discrimination is the mortal sin. Discrimination against somebody else. The lack of distinction between things and people and places, whatever, pays duty to cultural Marxism, not to Christianity. Marxism, that's a Marxist idea, not a Christian idea. The Christian left and the Marxists agree that there should be no distinction between people. Christian left and Marxism agree that there should be no distinction between people. That is, no distinction in economic, social, racial, gender, sexual orientation, and religious, unless it's established Christianity, then of course. Victims are made to order wherever they're found. If you found some new ones, we'll put them on the list too. I heard there's a new group out there now that since the new iPhone has got three cameras in the back of it, that's a little three thing, there's a phobia for that now because people are afraid of three little buttonholes. Well, that would be a group to cause for. Well, this becomes common cause. Kingdom building for the Christian and the perfected society, the utopia for the Marxist. Christianity gives into Marxist philosophy when it absolves the individual of responsibility, except not to be racist or homophobic, or whatever. Marxism promotes critical theory attacking established social structures. These are Christian in origin, or, you know, from the Bible, Jewish perhaps even, wherever they are found. So Marxism, by design, will destroy biblical Christianity, by design, leaving a hollowed-out moralistic shell. Christian, as a name, will drop off eventually. Social concerns are appeals to the emotion, and never to responsibility. So we ask of the Christian left, the Christian Marxists, how is the kingdom building going? I keep asking people that question. How's it going? You know, was it Dwayne asked in The Doors, you know, you got your system of coming to God by doing your good works. How are you doing? That's a good question. How are you doing with your system? How's it going? Because it appears to me things are going backward. What are your measures of progress, I would like to know? Well, it's quite easily seen that ever since Marxism has infiltrated the Christian ideals, first the mainline churches, now the Reformed churches, that Christianity and its appeal to saving the soul has been upgraded to deal with culture, now scorns anything Christian. That's an upgrade? We're making progress? Culture is more godless than it was when the fundamentalists held sway. Marxism always fails to bring about a better life and always destroys a Christian life. American society is so divided. Where is Marxist unity, I ask? Where is this, you know, grand promise that even the politicians cannot function, since the ideals of cultural Marxism rule everywhere, and especially in Washington? So observe, the critical theory is the attack, 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 never offer solutions. Marcuse would be the one to answer Horkheimer's question from the 1930s, who would replace the working class as the new vanguards of the materialist revolution, since none of them have showed up yet. Mark Hughes believed that it would be a victim coalition of minorities. It was 1923. Blacks, women, homosexuals. The social movements of the 1960s, we have black power, feminism, gay rights, sexual liberation, gave Mark Hughes a unique vehicle to release cultural Marxist ideas into the mainstream. Railing against all things establishment, which is Christian, Frankfurt School ideals caught on like wildfire across American universities. Mark Hughes then published Repressive Tolerance in 1965, as the various social improvements in America were in full swing. In it, he argued that tolerance of all values and ideals meant the repression of the others, which we say the correct ideas. It was here that Mark Hughes coined the term liberating tolerance. It called for tolerance of any ideas coming from the left, but intolerance for those from the right. One of the overarching themes of the Frankfurt School was total intolerance for the viewpoint of but its own. But this is also a basic trait of today's political correctness believers. You can't say anything unless they approve of it. So our last president and recent candidate for president were beacons of progressivism, which is Marxism. Both disciples of Saul Alinsky devoted cultural Marxist. And so now we live in a hypersensitive society in which social memes and feelings have overtaken the biological and objective reality. You know, what are you, a boy or a girl? Well, we don't know. You know, biological objective reality as the main deterrence of right and wrong, to say nothing about revelation. Political correctness is a war on logic and reason, and we would add on biblical Christianity. So what to think after such a wreck? Well, the question always comes up about these people that are Marxists. I have to admit that reading the testimony of the conversion of Richard Stearns, who's the president of World Vision, who wrote Hole in My Gospel, it is likely that he is born again soul. I mean, extensive testimony, page after page after page, and so we must not think that he is saved. We must not think who is saved is therefore trustworthy. Has he been taken in by a false ideal? That's a question. Does he promote what comes from truth? From here, there is hope, if we start there, to sort out these right answers. Don't ask whether they're Christians or not. And I try to stay away from that, although I have said my opinion in some places. It doesn't matter whether they're Christians or not. It's what they're doing is what you judge. So we have, in passing, met many personalities, and my screen is only wide for five. There's many more. Many who hold to evangelical doctrines, as covenantalists do, yet because there is a flaw in the biblical understanding of the expanded gospel in the coming kingdom now, these critical truths skew the Christianity for others. They may have it right, but they mess everybody up that comes to listen to them. While some leaders are orthodox, they attract the unconverted with their false idealism of utopian kingdom living, and they remain lost. So we must remember that we cannot enumerate all the errors of Marxism that have leaked into the religious. But we can state the purpose of the church, which is by definition able to exclude everything except being the pillar and support of the truth. You don't have to know about all these things. You just know, this is what we do. Well, about that? We don't do that. We do this. Well, what about this? We don't do that. We do this. Exclude everything except pillar and support of the truth. And this must be held no matter how emotional the human appeal is. And they can be. We've seen the ads for pets when they play Silent Night in the background. So preach the word in season, out of season, Paul told Timothy. It changes the heart, maybe culture, don't care. Maybe it changes the culture, and I think there are places where enough have been saved that actually culture changes. The police forces have been reduced. Not the objective, but that happens. But most importantly, it changes the eternal destinies, which is more important than any improvement in a doomed culture. Now we come to the answer to the hardest question. Why is it that in our day, we have the unqualified embrace of cultural Marxism? Well, one, Marxism has lost its stigma as an anti-God system of thought. That's why I did what I did last week. I gave you how it sounds to an 82-year-old guy. It's not going to sound like that to an 18-year-old. Marxism has no fear for him or her. So violent Marxism has become cultural Marxism. Instead of violence, cultural, equal to cultural Christianity. But you always got to remember, if this doesn't work and there's power in these people that end up being in political power, when they lose, they will use political force to implement it by violence. That will happen. That's what happened in Lenin. That's what happened with Muhammad when he started Islam. His first argument was, join us, we're peaceful. We're not going to do it. Well, then we'll kill you. You know, you got your chance. So this same kind of thing will happen here, did other places. So cultural Marxism has used critical theory to destroy old Orthodox Christianity, biblical Christianity, and its concerns for the soul. And then they lay guilt on people for not assisting in the sufferings of the underclass. What does your church do for the poor? Nothing. Well, when critical theory has accomplished its mission, that is, wipes the slate clean, to silence the warning of impending personal judgment, it is easy to offer a meaningful life in rescuing the oppressed. If you get rid of the judgment, then you can do the other. Still yet, there's another element. For the older members of the Orthodox faith, being saved are not taken in by the critical theory, having seen the attacks on Christianity from the modernist liberals before. I've seen that before. They're doing it again. It's easy for us to see this coming. For them, it is easy to see the value lost of a personal Savior based on the death, burial of Christ. We see what happens if that's out of Christianity. Thus, it destroys Christianity. But the new generation has fallen victim to these hidden reefs of Marxist destruction. They don't see it sailing in life. It is like that many of these next generation will have not been saved at all. They find their life meaningless, empty, and seek a higher cause than they have seen demonstrated by their parents or in their church for whatever reason in their religious culture, and they reject it. And I just ask, this challenge to us, have we been giving them a false picture? I know you can't change unbelief. Well, the world is obviously degenerating. Global warming and injustices everywhere. No one seems to care, Monk says. To save humanity and the world, our threatened existence becomes the highest calling to our 16-year-old girl who's now saying this, that the corporations have to shape up and stop this silliness and because we're all going to die here. And if she thinks it, does others think it too? Nothing less than complete child abuse, someone called it. And I think that's true. Nothing less than complete personal abandonment to the cause to make life better. And for them, it's a most noble work. To put it in spiritual language, they are building the kingdom of God.